once.
Good evening, everyone. There is indeed a riot going on. This is your host tonight, Brene Shaker. We have a really terrific show this evening. We're going to take a break from the usual people trying to save the world and bring you something lighter. We've got our summer art show. We've got a great lineup. We have some poetry, some music, some artists, and a writer that's going to join us later on. But first, let's hear from Rick in the news.
This news just in. Foreign nuclear experts late last month blasted TEPCO's lack of transparency over radioactive leaks. The operator of Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear plant has given its first public estimate of the size of the leakage of radioactive tritium into the Pacific Ocean since the disaster. And they say between 20 trillion to 40 trillion becquerels of the substance is estimated to have leaked into the sea since May 2011. It was the first such figure TEPCO has released since a massive tsunami led to the accident back in March of 2011. An accident that continues. Disaster sent reactors into meltdown, forced the evacuation of tens of thousands of residents in the worst atomic accident since Chernobyl in 1986. It was only last month that the embattled operator confirmed long-held suspicions of ocean contamination from the shattered reactors, as Japan's nuclear watchdog cast doubt on the utility's earlier claims that the toxic water was contained in the facility. TEPCO has said the scale of the radioactive tritium leak from May 2011 to July 2013 was around the level which would have been allowed under safety regulations before the accident, 22 trillion becquerels annually at the 6-reactor plant. Utility said it would also estimate the amount of cancer-causing strontium, which may have leaked over the years. The operator has said the levels of ocean underground water have risen as workers built shields to prevent the groundwater from seeping into the ocean. The company, which faces huge cleanup and compensation costs, has struggled with the massive amount of radioactive water accumulating as a result of continued water injections to cool the reactors. Mystery steam notwithstanding. A series of problems at the reactor site, including TEPCO's secretiveness, has drawn blunt criticism at home and abroad. Foreign nuclear experts late last month blasted TEPCO's lack of transparency. These actions indicate that you, TEPCO, don't know what you're doing. You do not have a plan, and you are not doing all you can to protect the environment and the people. Dale Klein, former head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, told a panel in Tokyo. And for those of you who thought the disaster in Florida's election system was over, well, guess what? The Supreme Court has let loose the dogs. The renewed scrub of Florida's voter list has election officials on edge. Tallahassee. Governor Rick Scott will soon launch a new hunt for non-citizens on the Florida voter rolls, a move that's sure to provoke new cries of voter purge as Scott ramps up his own re-election effort. Similar searches a year ago were rife with errors, finding a few ineligible voters and led to lawsuits by advocacy groups who said it was disproportionately targeting Hispanics, Haitians, and other minority groups. Those searches were handled clumsily and angered county election supervisors who lost confidence in the state's list of names. It was sloppy, it was slapdash, it was inaccurate, said Polk County Supervisor of Elections Lori Edwards, and that was the best one. They were sending us names of people to remove because they were born in Puerto Rico. It was disgusting. Over time, the state's initial list of suspected non-citizens shrank from 182,000 to 2,600 down to 198 before election supervisors suspended their search as the presidential election drew near. That was embarrassing, said election chief Jerry Holland in Jacksonville's Duval County. It has to be better scrub of names than we've had before. Election supervisors remain wary of a new voting effort, which the U.S. Supreme Court effectively authorized in June when it struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act. That ruling nullified a federal lawsuit in Tampa that sought to stop new searches for non-citizen voters, and Scott quickly renewed his call for action. If there's anybody we think isn't voting properly from the standpoint that they didn't have a right to vote, I think we need to do an investigation, Scott said, as the day of the high court decision. Last fall, Scott joined the Republican Party in a fundraising appeal that accused Democrats of defending the right of non-citizens to vote, solving another non-issue. Scott's top election official, Secretary of State Ken Denzner, is now creating a new list of suspected non-citizens by cross-checking the state voter data with a federal database managed by the Department of Homeland Security. I just wonder what colors that security will be. Denzner's Director of Elections, Maria Matthews, sent a letter to election supervisors Friday promising responsible measures that ensure due process and the integrity of Florida's voter rolls, whether sesame or onion. Now on to other news. Japan's first astronaut says the government lies about the Fukushima disaster. Vital information on radiation risks are being kept from the public to maintain law and order. former TBS reporter and Japan's first ever astronaut, Toyohiro Aikiyama, his home was only 32 kilometers from Fukushima. On March 12th, he packed a few valuables, hung a portable radiation detector around his neck, and drove his truck to the city of Toriyama. As a former newsman, Aikiyama was well aware not only of the official reactions to the 1986 Chernobyl disaster and other nuclear accidents in the past, but also of the workings of Japan's nuclear village. Consequently, he knew the Tokyo government would withhold vital information on radioactive risks to maintain law and order. I had reported on the fifth anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster and the Three Mile Island accident, so I knew all too well what the governments of the U.S. and Russia had done. Now on to another story. A plutonium gang, CH2M Hill, dismantles the Hanford nuclear site. Before entering the shuttered plutonium finishing plant in the Hanford site, Jerry Long hangs his identification badge on a board outside the entrance so rescue crews can easily figure out who's inside, should it come to that. This is a no-kidding hazardous Category 2 nuclear facility, he said, and the Department of Energy reserves the category for sites that might blow up, or, as they like to call it, experience a criticality event. There's enough residual plutonium to build 10 bombs the size of the one that destroyed Nagasaki. The plant's highly contaminated, not only with plutonium, but also with byproducts such as hexavalent chromium, made infamous by Aaron Brockovich. The Department of Energy estimates that over the years, some 450 billion gallons of industrial and radiological contaminant were dumped directly into the soil. Some of it was stored in Hanford's aging complex of 177 underground tanks, contained 53 million gallons of chemicals and radioactive liquids. 67 of the tanks have together leaked more than a million gallons. DOE recently identified six more tanks that have sprung leaks, further threatening the water supply of millions across the Northwest. For those of you not quite sure whose bread is buttered, the Obama campaign manager who helped elect President Obama, Jim Messina, is now going to spend his time working to get conservatives elected, but it will be conservatives in the UK. The Conservative Party has hired Barack Obama's campaign manager, Jim Messina, for its general election campaign team, BBC Newsnight has learned. Sources confirmed he would act as the campaign strategy advisor to the Conservative Party. Lifelong Democrat Mr. Messina masterminded the U.S. president's successful 2012 election campaign. The political parties in Westminster are readying themselves for a general election now, just under 2 years ahead. And the last story I'll be able to get to tonight, you can look for more at averyvoice.com. This is about a frag gag banning children also from talking about fracking forever. When drilling company Range Resources offered the Halowich family a $750,000 settlement to relocate from their fracking-polluted home in Washington County, Pennsylvania, it came with a common restriction. Chris and Stephanie Halowich would be forgiven from ever speaking about fracking or the Marcellus Shale. But one element of the gag order was all new. The Halowich's two children, ages 7 and 10, would be subject to the same restrictions, banned from speaking about their family's experience for the rest of their lives. For this and other stories in completion, please go to averyvoice.com for more details.
Thank
and now, back
you.
To Renee.
Thank you, Rick. Well, we're going to kick off our summer art show with our own resident poet, Mr. Rick himself. We have a piece here, A Behaviorist Perspective, The Causes of Racism.
A Behaviorist Perspective, The Causes of Racism. The troop, or group, the Klan's glad hand, the sign of nine, the grip in the dark, the posted mark informs the stable state of norms, remembering the frames of membrane games, brain disguises, shade your eyes in apple pies, it sizes the territory, the turf. Well, the good should. Our side of town, our group is right, in the sight of good God's smile. Even sunlight reviles your kind outside the pure, to lure with your kind's lazy, stupid stunts. A sparrow of a different hue could be torn and cloven too by a few of another blue hunt. The strength, bounding, bonding, unicellular life in multicellular strife, responding, besiding, ties the atom so tight, minute, molecular might, and chooses in precise measure who you'll sleep with tonight. Beehives survive by tribe's trance. The queen's romance excludes the rude outsider, protects the provider, determines the rider of the queen's desire, embolden invaders, reduce the chance for the tribe to advance. Social groups and bamboo shoots, baboon troops and fishy schools know who the foe is, when to go, who's the friend, where's the end. The rules used, training fools by gene and team wish, that's culture's dish. It keeps the Portuguese man of war banging on the door. It explains to the colony who'd hang on to and why. Cultural clash, like red ants and black, as a reason to attack is a common step to keep them hep to good guys and bad. But isn't it sad how often the supportive social ties, the tools of molecular rules, can conceal the lack and leak of the social contract to the greater stack? The organs of your hand would be foolish to war or inflict harm on the arm. Could the leg force the knee to submit or flee? Could the brow to the forehead say, drop dead, be gone, amscray? And then, in confusion, sway against the neighbor's array, as this is, to make a fist to relate the cultural trait, a boundary in this or any country. Take Humpty Dumpty. He's really something, to relate to the ground with a loud cracking sound. Unicellular or multicellular, in clothing and in motion, you're expressing the notion of your tribe. It doesn't hide, wouldn't try, but membranes even say, if you lean over easy this way, together is stronger, lives happier longer. Cultural rifts needn't cause tiffs or express fists in pain what it is when they mean the support of us. They needn't bleed trust or force us to muss the membrane's edgy thrust. But if you say it must, symbiosis is being, osmosis its meaning, surely you know this. There's no relief in grief. Let tribal libel cease. Extend the grace of space. The use of social bonding to unite is great. But even edges meet and act to attract the surging urge to merge. A Behaviorist Perspective, The Causes of Racism.
Some words for thought from our resident poet, Rick Spezak. Thank you, Rick.
Well, you're very welcome.
Our next guest tonight is Vicki Richards. She is a classical Indian violinist, a master, delightful person, and we're going to get to her right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome a very special guest. This is a wonderful performer and artist who I've had the good fortune to know for many years. I have the honor of calling her friend. I'd like to introduce Miss Vicki Richards, a very talented artist. Welcome, Vicki.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Oh, very good. Very good.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It's our pleasure, believe me. Our show is normally about progressive activists who are working on building a better world. I regard our artist friends and colleagues as a part of that work to make a better world. What you do with your vibrational space builds a better world. I know, I've seen it. So let me dig right in. You've been a professional performer for many years. How did you start playing? Did you just start with violin or did you start with piano?
How did I start playing? Thanks to the public school system in my home state of Rhode Island, they handed out instruments in fourth grade. And I guess somewhere along the way, someone noticed I was taking to it pretty easily. And I also had a father who I didn't know for long and wasn't on the planet for long, but when he heard me play, he said, you should do that. he was a musician, and so it was thanks to public school and encouragement from them and from parents that got me launched.
Did you start with violin, or did you start with some other instrument?
I started with violin at what is now, I guess, considered a ripe old age of 9.
No kidding.
Yeah, but people had noticed that I had focus. That was rare. I was more interested in nature, in the natural world, on the shoreline, picking out. My first love probably was nature and horses.
Uh-huh.
Just something about the relationship between animals and humans and tuning into maybe a different level, different vibration already.
Well, you know, that actually leads me right to my second question. I know you as a multi-talented artist who works in a variety of genres. So my next question is this. Did the spiritual seeking come first, or the Indian music come first, or was it simultaneous?
That's a great question, and I've not been asked it in that way. I'm not sure how to answer it. I'm going to wing it, as I normally do in improvisation, which means trying to bring some of my vocabulary into a coherent statement. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it's just stream of consciousness. I think I was in development, and while you're developing as a musician, over the 10 years or so before I even heard Indian music, just as a player, developing, honing those the synapses and developing the inner focus and attention to the oral world, somehow is a practice of its own that may have made me open to or on a parallel track to a spiritual practice. Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely.
I guess I've never formed it that way, but I see it as a path of a discipline and a practice, and it's certainly been a healing form and a healing element, as well as entering a divine channel at times. There's no doubt about it. The resonance from beyond the three dimensions.
Sure.
For me.
So,
for me.
You were tuned to this. When were you introduced to Indian music formally? Was it courses in college or high school, or you heard it and sought it out?
Let's see. Instead of my standard answer, I'm going to go back a little, which is I heard this East Meets West collaboration of Yehudi Menuhin, who I respected very much.
Sure.
A classical, wonderful international violinist, and this sitar player called Ravi Shankar, and I didn't know what he was doing. So I heard Mr. Menuhin, Sir Menuhin, play. Later on in life, I had the opportunity to speak with him and ask him a couple of questions, which was so good for me. But really, I heard Shakti, the group John McLaughlin,
sure,
Shankar, Zakir Hussain, playing, and it was at the point where I was just meeting a tabla player who would later become my husband.
Uh-huh.
And we were starting to formulate things, and I came out of an avant-garde jazz ensemble, the Jerry Gentry Quintet up in Rhode Island, and I was in transition, and I heard that, and once I started to learn about tabla and the Indian system of rhythm, I understood part of what was going on, and it was very exciting. And when I received a professional development grant to go to India, the Smithsonian University of Chicago helped fund me because I was already a professional. And in 1979, I'd say, what was when the real work and real education about raga and the whole tradition and system of Indian music began for me.
Let me ask you this. We all know musicians, or many of us are fortunate enough to know musicians, some of whom are spiritual, some of whom are less so. Some really think of their music as a discipline. In your studies of Indian music, and especially in your introductory phase, was it consciously a mental practice, or was it really a music practice that had a component to that, and it just kind of evolved into a more spiritual as well as musical experience?
I'd say it was an evolution, and it came through sitting down and sweating through the hours of unlearning Western music and learning a whole new foreign different system. And it took a couple of years of just showing up for that practice, and little by little my eyes or my ears were open to more and more. And honestly, it took me a couple of years to really hear what vocalists were doing rather than just instrumentalists to get the nuances. And it's like a new color was added to the rainbow.
Well, for people who are familiar with Western music, aren't there many more tones in the Indian scales than there are in the Western scales?
Well, there are the spaces between the notes which are utilized. So if we have, say, 12 notes in the typical Western, the chromatic scale, you can use 12 notes in Indian music. You can use 5, but it's the duration, the lingering, the timbre, and the volume of a vocalist that will define the space between those notes, and it tells you which rag is being played.
I see.
I don't know if that makes any sense, but
sure.
So how you get from one note to another is very important. Rather, in Western, you know, when we're reading off a page with black dots on it, we are readers of something that's been created by somebody else, and we are excellent at reproducing what's there. It's like data entry. And I played professional classical music in orchestras for at least 10 years. Now, for Indian music, what you do, the system of learning is so different in that it's a teacher to disciple. It's a one-on-one. It's an oral tradition. It's not notated. So it comes from your ears, but it also creatively comes from within you once you get the vocabulary.
So a raga, per se, isn't so much notated as improvised within a frame. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Right. It's not notated at all, and it is improvised with a set of rules and regulations. There is room for your voice to be developed, but there is freedom within the boundaries that are set. And once you recognize those boundaries, it's such a wonderful ride.
Well, we've been talking about your wonderful music for so long, and you've played classical Western music, you've played jazz from straight ahead to avant-garde, and now you have this wonderful mix of sounds from the East and the West. Let me go ahead and play one of your tunes, and then we can talk a little bit more about the recording and your music, okay?
Thank you. Fine.
My goodness, that was lovely.
Oh, that was so much fun to play.
So this is a relatively recent recording?
Yes, that's from She Vanishes, which is the most recent of my five solo studio albums.
Well, fantastic. How can people get access to more Vicki Richards music?
I think if you just type in my name, you'll come to CD Baby, you'll see my website. There are a number of YouTube videos out there. I have a few performances coming up. I'm working with choreographers these days, which is also fun to create for modern dance.
When are your upcoming performances and where?
Let's see, coming up September, I think it's 22nd, at FIU, I'll be playing with Jeff Dean, The Music of North India, the classical form for Genres of the World at the Wertheim. February, the first weekend at Pinecrest Gardens, the Old Parrot Jungle with Karen Peterson Dancers. And there's something big that may be coming up April 12th at the Deering Estate, and I hope everyone will watch for that. It has to do with water. I'm actually coming off a very exciting conversation with someone about participating in a national waterdance.org, which is university, mostly dancers, simultaneous, you know, the syncing up on the online, creating a theme together, but going their own ways and coming back. I wanted to be part of something more connected because we need to protect the water.
Absolutely.
And it should be down at the Deering Estate on April 12th, and maybe I'll be volunteering my services for that. Yeah.
Like I said, keep me informed. You, I think, have my email address, and I'm going to buy me some Vicki Richards music right away. Okay. You know, if you ever play in Palm Beach, you better let me know.
Well, if I will, I sure would let you know.
Okay.
Who knows what's coming?
Well, it was such a great blend of you know, spiritual tonalities and jazz. I just thought it was delicious.
Thank you. Got good ears and a great heart. Thank you. Boy, I appreciate this a lot, and I be well all the way around. Keep healthy.
Okay. Take care, my dear.
All right, we'll be in touch. Bye, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. That was absolutely lovely. Our next guest is an artist. She comes from New York City, where she's had a successful 20-year career with the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Her expertise is Egyptian faience. That's like seance, but with an F. But before we bring Carol on, Carol Strick, I want to read something to you. Listen very carefully and remember, because we're going to come back to this. But this is a poem entitled Our Little Secrets. First, it was innocent hugs and pecks on the cheeks. Then it was tickles and strange caresses. All of that turned into kisses on the mouth, exploring my body with his sweaty hands, touching me as I lay sleeping, coming to me naked in the middle of the night. I wanted him to stop. It didn't feel right, touching me, touching him. Felt so wrong. Didn't know how to stop it. He always said to me, "Don't tell anyone, Pauly. It's our little secret." Told me it was my fault. I was evil for making him act this way. All those tears of guilt and shame. Precious childhood years wasted, all for naught, all caught up inside me. I remember the voice, his sweaty shaking hands, the pain of him inside me, and the echo of his words. I love you, Pauly. I really love you. But the face, that face is still a mystery to me. 26 years later, still 5 years old, Pauly is still trapped inside me, crying, scared, alone. We still see him every night when the lights go out. I feel him touching me. I hear him telling me, "Don't tell anyone, Pauly. It's our little secret." I can't let go of him. I don't know how. Carol, are you with us? Carol, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm here. Do you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me. I'll add that Paul X, who wrote that poem, was released 10 years ago from a prison in Michigan. 2 weeks after he was released, he checked himself into a mental hospital by the name of Caprice, and he jumped off the roof and killed himself. He couldn't live. He didn't get any mental health care in prison. He didn't get anything to alleviate his situation. It just festered with him. And when he was finally ready to parole, he wasn't ready to live in the world.
It's such a sad story, and I remember when you shared it with me, Carol. I want to ask you, your work now, since you've moved to Florida, you have worked with prisoners around the country in getting their art out to the public. But before we go into the specifics of this, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in all this? Tell us the background of how this began for you.
Well, actually, my two careers overlapped, which was a good thing because I was still in New York and I read in a zine, I remember it, Bayou La Rose from Tacoma, Washington. And there were two queries in there. One said, lonely prisoner seeks pen pal. And the other one said, prisoner artist seeks pen pal. And I thought to myself that I'm an artist, so I would write to the artist, but I would also write to the other prisoner. It turns out the lonely prisoner was very political. He was connected to the IRA, and he knew just about everything going on in this entirely new world of zines and organizations, all kinds of people. The other prisoner, the artist, was from the Winnebago tribe, and he sent me back a drawing. That was probably the saddest drawing I had ever seen. It made Goya and the Guernica look didn't have an impact. And it dawned on me as an artist that you had to live this sorrow to be able to put it on paper, a canvas. What happened was the prisoner, the political prisoner, Harold, he sent me the name of a magazine in California, and he said he thought I should ask for an issue because they devoted a lot of space to prisoners, and I would understand a lot more with what I was dealing with. So I did write to them. The woman answered me, and she asked me if I would go up to Mariana Prison in Florida and visit a woman who had was four-pointed, tied her wrists and ankles tied to a slab of cement for 23 days. And the reason why they did this is because she tried to commit suicide. It was almost incredulous. So I did go up to Mariana. I did visit Loretta. And I came back to South Florida. By this time, I had moved to Florida. And I alerted all the women's organizations, NOW and WILF, the Women's International for Peace and Freedom. I told them all what happened to Loretta, and they said, well, where did this happen, in China? So I said, no, it happened in Florida. And they said, well, that's impossible. That doesn't happen here. When I finally convinced them it did happen, I started a letter-writing campaign to Governor Childs that this shouldn't happen to anybody. And all the women started writing letters. So in the middle of the night, they brought a Learjet to the prison and took Loretta to Texas, to Carswell, which is the federal loony bin. And anybody who they can't diagnose is naturally crazy. So that's their version. So they put her in there.
To get her to silence her and this
exactly
and this,
and to
work.
Keep her away from the public, right? Exactly, to hide her actually. So what happened was, I wrote up what happened, the whole story about 14-hour traveling, changing all these buses, going up to Mariana, how Mariana looked. There were cannons on the lawn. It's the federal women's prison in Florida. And how going to the SHU, the special housing, how difficult it was to visit, and how they groped and searched you and looked in your bra and you took off your shoes. The whole thing was, it seemed to me like it was an overkill and it was unnecessary. But anyway, that was the formality. So I visited Loretta. I visited her twice, as a matter of fact. And then I wrote it up for that magazine. And the woman loved what I wrote, the editor. The magazine was called North Coast Express. And it really had heavy hitters, Michael Parenti and every leftist thinker that you ever heard of, Mike Levine, they were all in North Coast Express. And the person who did the covers was a prisoner in Leavenworth who had spent 23 years in solitary confinement in the basement of Leavenworth. In any event, I wrote it up, and people responded very well, especially the prisoners, because we sent about 1,000 copies inside, and prisoners passed things one to the other until they're almost threadbare. So literally thousands of prisoners read it. So they wrote back, and they wrote to me through the magazine. So before you know it, I don't know how many people I was corresponding in so many states, but after 2 years of this, I thought to myself, I ought to turn this into an art show, because having worked at the museum, I knew how powerful art was and that the natural questions are about the artist and the what gave him the food for that subject. What was he thinking about? It reveals a lot about the artist. So I wrote in my next column, I said, I'm thinking about starting an art show. If anybody in your pod or your unit is an artist, give them my name and address and ask them to send a piece of art. Well, before you know it, I had so much art. It was more than I knew what to do with. And I did find a place in New York that was, you know, happy to have the show. It went very well, and it just grew by itself. For one thing, the money from
Carol,
the sales
you,
is going.
If I can, if I could just interrupt for a second, this show that you put together in New York, how did you come to select which pieces went in this show out of all these submissions?
Well,
that you
at that point, it wasn't really. I was just beginning, so there were a few heavy hitters. Others, there are a lot of very mediocre artists in prison, just like there are out here. You know, out of maybe 1 out of 100 could be an excellent artist, or 1 out of 50, or 1 out of 200, or 2 out of 300. So it was the same thing with the prisoners. A lot of the work I got I got a lot of art, but a lot of it was very fair. Some was really good, but this was only the beginning. What happened was, I showed the art, I sold some, sent the prisoners the money. And needless to say, once word got out that this was about their benefit, and that I was doing this to change the public's misconception of prisoners. I wanted the public to see the prisoners as I saw them. I wanted them to understand that the prisoners have kept their humanity and their sanity and their clear vision intact despite being caged and being brutalized day after day. And their creative sense was there intact. One woman put it very well. She said, they can take away our supplies, but they can't take away our creative spirit. And that's what I plugged into. As it turned out, because I worked for a museum at that time, I was able to send a lot of postcards. In other words, as a frame of reference, these artists were essentially artists, whether they were graffiti artists or street artists. It didn't matter. They had an artist sensibility, but they were cheated from an art education that they wanted. So I just kind of came in like a missing link and was able to send, I'd say to somebody, you paint like Seurat, and they'd say, who's Seurat? So I can send postcards from the Met of Seurat or Pizarro or Matisse or anybody. And the same with the books. I told the guy who ran the warehouse at the museum what I was doing, and he thought it was a great idea. So I said, if you get books back, because it has a little mark on it and the customer doesn't want it, if you wouldn't mind sending some to the prisoners, because it has to come from a bookstore, it would really be a help to them and it would be a boost. He said, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll do that. So things began on this art note. And
How long ago was this?
Okay. This was actually 20 years ago.
Okay.
I've been
doing
this 20 years.
And how has it progressed since then? You've been able to...
Well, I have to say that art-wise, As far as the quality is concerned, I personally have never seen anything like this in my life. And I think it has a lot to do with, for one thing, working with a lot of the same people for these 20 years, watching them progress, encouraging them, and then selling their work for them, just like any art dealer would do, and sending them the money. So everybody was very happy with this arrangement. And the artist had confidence to keep working. And sometimes somebody who wasn't an artist, who I wrote to because of the column, there was a guy in Florida who said, there's a guy in this prison who's a great artist. I think you should see his work. And I said, well, just give my name and address, which he did. And he was a wonderful artist. That thing I gave you, The Door to Cruelty, he did that with a number of other pieces. So it just went by word of mouth and the quality. To me, the quality was important because I was looking at these artists as representatives of the entire 2.5 million people who were incarcerated in the United States. They were the spokespeople because everybody has a talent. Everybody can do something. And I wanted the public to see this is who these people really are.
Now, a lot of the art that you showed me was obviously infused with their own personal experience of incarceration and the brutality of life that they had experienced probably even before their jail time. So these are not happy pictures. A lot of these are very intense and very driven by a need to express this brutality, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, I'd agree 100%. What I love about this particular art show is that a lot of times when you see prisoner art, people say, the person organizing it says, well, this can't be too political. This is a political situation. These prisoners are all victims. Some might have victimized others, but they themselves are victims of racism, poverty, and or child abuse. So there's nobody in there by accident. Everybody's been hurt. And it's just, what do we do with these hurt people? Well, let's lock them up. And worse, let's make money on them. So let's privatize it. Let's sell it on Wall Street. I mean, this is really an obscene situation here. And as it's growing and we have more and more prisoners and we're building more and more prisons, I'm starting to wonder what kind of a society we're living in. We have more prisoners here than China.
Right.
So
there's
something radically wrong.
Let's come back to that.
Back to the art.
What I want to do is, unfortunately, since we can't show our audience the art, what I do want to read is this piece from The Door to Cruelty that you mentioned a moment ago. A lot of this art is annotated with the artist's own interpretation and origins of the pieces that they draw or sketch or paint. And this is a piece that was written to The Door to Cruelty.
Right.
This drawing represents a door to learning the cruelty of the prison before knowing the world. The drugs and the money are balanced on top of the scale of envy, hate, and betrayal. Killing for money or drugs is not a personal intuition. A child does not convert to an assassin because his mother taught him in the womb. Nobody kills for the hatred that his father has for the government, and nobody does drugs for necessity, because you need it or because you want to be accepted in that society. You learn this since the day you were born. Behind each prison door are souls or spirits, or in other cases, children that are gang members, drug addicts, and assassins or murderers. There are also children with white hearts and black ones, with or without families. They are also lonely and abandoned children. In the free society, there are men who are brainwashed. A religion or a belief has taken the heart out. And it is said that every child comes protected by two angels, although I have never seen mine. 99.9% of the youth in prison are mistreated. In prison, there is no dignity. The social readjustment doesn't exist. The prisoners are being inundated And unfortunately, the survivors are those who have a solid fundamental family behind them. In this drawing, there is a girl or a woman who is pregnant, who is God to permit the horrible and painful situation of bringing a little creature into this world under these conditions. In every city, there is a mother and a father, and in every prison, there are hundreds of boys and girls that need to be reminded that even under these circumstances, they have a mother and father. That is a very telling expression of anguish.
And I showed you the drawing. In prison, you can't get a large piece of paper. So if you want to draw a large piece, let's say 22 by 26, which is large by prison standards, then you have to attach four or six pieces of paper together to get a large sheet, or you can trade the guy in the laundry who's about to throw out an old sheet, ask him for a large piece, and then trade him either stamps or dinners, three dinners or 10 stamps and three dinners, whatever your arrangement is. This guy who did this drawing, yes, he has a lot to say. He's a very bright guy and very talented guy. And if you remember the drawing, it is just chock full of images of what the only thing he would have been exposed to outside, in addition to the horrors of being born in prison and only knowing that brutalized world, but that it's about drugs, guns, sex, the few things from Demimonde that he knows or that he would have been exposed to. So he's got all kinds of symbols and all kinds of numbers and all kinds of things. And that's not uncommon in these prison drawings, to use the clock because the time passes slowly. Different symbols that the weapons, the barbed wire, the locks, the handcuffs, mace, hoses, clubs, whatever you can think of, anything to torture people or hurt people is thrown into these drawings because this is what these prisoners are faced with every day. And if they want you to have a message, it's that this is how we live. Let me read you a short paragraph by a prisoner who, what happened was, I had sent him a copy of a drawing from a prison who had been killed in Texas on death row by George Bush when he was governor. And the prisoner called me to say goodbye. And I said, goodbye? Where are you going? And he said, well, I'm going to die in 2 hours. I said, what? And I said, what about our letters? And what about all the letters from church people and religious people? I couldn't believe they were going to kill him. But they did kill him. In any event, this prisoner wrote me back, and he said that the artist who was executed made a profound impression, and he wrote to say that it's not so much our flesh and blood and our meager properties that they desire. Oh, no, it's our spirit and our vision and our insight. They need to see crushed and pulverized by the weight and pain of their actions against us. More than any other creature within the human spectrum, artists understand this. That's why all of the most repressive and brutal of governments throughout history have worked so diligently and mercilessly to control the arts. The arts are mankind's connection to the highest self. And that's what I see in these prisoners, and that's why I did this. I want other people to see these prisoners as I do, not as prisoners, but as artists who didn't have an opportunity to be artists out here, so they're doing as best they can under conditions that I personally as an artist could not have worked in those conditions. But I guess unfortunately you get used to it, and as awful as it is, you still, it's important for you to do your art.
To survive for many of these people.
Yeah,
I can't imagine what
survival.
It's like about having this outlet.
Exactly. Well, everybody has some outlet. There are a lot of poets. There are people who just decorate envelopes, do different things, but somehow you have to have some break from the boredom of prison or for your slave job, which, by the way, every Fortune 500 company is in the prisons. When people talk about the prisoners in a very negative way, and then they talk about their credit card, and I have to remind them, oh, by the way, the prisoners are taking your information on your credit card. The same person you're afraid of is the person who's doing the transaction for you. The girls in New York are answering the phone as they're the Motor Vehicle Bureau. They're not. They're in a prison on 20th Street. So, I mean, the prisoners are used and abused in a lot of ways, and if this is the way the country's going, that we're using this prison population as a cheap labor force, well, I don't think it's going to stay this way very long. I think it's whether there's some act of God or something happens, an earthquake, more storms, more fires, more floods, that we just can't keep this going the way it is. If every human being doesn't have a chance to have a meaningful life, then there's really no point to the society.
Carol, you've been doing this now for 20 years. Do you have anything in the works at the present?
Well, actually, I have to add that my entire life has turned into harassment for the most part. Harassment, and it's just nonstop. So that, yes, I do have, one I'll mention because she did, if it works out fine, if they get to her and it doesn't work out, well, that's all right, too. And that was in UU in North Palm Beach, and she called me, the woman in charge, and said, save January. Two others I have that I don't want to mention because I really hope they do work out. Unfortunately, the prison crats are running the post office and they're running the phones. Well, we know from the NSA scandal that the telephone company turns over their records. So it's very hard for activists who are trying to help the prisoners to get a lot of things done. It becomes very frustrating because the post office has taken this mail tampering into a science or a fine art. I have a collection of stickers from my mail that different stickers are on different letters, and it's just so crazy, the whole thing. And the same thing with the phone, the sleep deprivation, the phone rings in the middle of the night just to wake you up, and then somebody hangs up, and it's all these terrible things. So that's why I wish I could say more about what I hope to do. And what I'll do is, if the one I really want works out, I'll let you know and you can announce it on the air yourself.
Please do. Please keep us posted, Carol. Your work is absolutely amazing. You've hit upon a part of society that few people know about, and even fewer want to know about it, but yet it touches us all. And the fact that you've been able to bring this art and the humanity of these people into the public is a tremendous dedication and to be commended. So I guess what I'd like to wrap up with is, if there are people who are interested in getting involved, are there any places they could go or any resources that are out there that they could turn to?
Offhand, I mean, there are things like the ACLU Prison Project. That's their office in Washington, D.C. But if anybody wants to call me, you can give them my number. And I know prisoners who want pen pals, for one thing. So if anybody is looking to write to a prisoner, well, I can certainly supply them with names and addresses. But as far as that's the best way, I think, to get in touch is a direct contact, to write to a prisoner and see how it goes from there. There are organizations like Critical Resistance, which their main office is in California. There's FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and I think they have an office in Florida. Oh, I think they have one in Gainesville. Gainesville has a few of these groups that are supporting the prisoners, and some you can look in the Gainesville Iguana, and they'll list when they meet and where they are. There's unfortunately, well, around here actually, the students at FAU from the Alcatraz situation have gotten involved with the prisoners, and they're really terrific. And if anybody wants to contact them, they have a website. I think it's called Owlcatraz, OWL, because that's the mascot of their team. Remember that the students didn't want the stadium to be named for GEO, the private prison group. And that really galvanized the students, and it's and they're still at this. So if anybody want to look them up online, they can do that. I'm in the phone book. Anybody can call me and come over and see the art if they want. As far as I know, the UU in North Palm Beach told me to keep January open, which I will, and I hope that works out because it's nearby. And the other two, well, I'm afraid to hex myself because you don't know the lengths I have to go to even get in touch with somebody when you know you're under surveillance and you don't really feel free to use the mail and phone like you ordinarily would. And if that's some kind of a crime, trying to help destitute people, well, that's fine. You know, if that's what, if that's the value system, it's very sad. But
well,
don't
Carol,
forget, this is a business. It's about making money at the expense of people who are basically victims of poverty and racism.
Yes, an unfortunate part of our society. So, well, Carol, thank you so very much.
Oh, thank
for
you very much,
coming
Renee,
on
for
and,
having me.
Yeah, I wish you all the best.
Can, thank you. Can come over, and when the show I really want to happen, hopefully it will, I'll call you and you can put it on the air, and anybody who's interested can come. The thing about UU is it's near here. I don't know where your audience is. Maybe you know, they're all over the country, but we're here. I'm here in Florida in West Palm Beach.
Okay, well, you let us know. Thanks again, Carol.
Sure, I sure will. Thank you, Renee. Good luck. Okay. I'm going to listen for another second. Is that okay for your next
guest? That's fine. Please stay with
Thanks.
Us.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have our next guest is Ellen Christie. And Ellen is a jazz singer. She's traveled the world. She's a producer, creative consultant. Ellen, hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you this evening?
Great, good.
Ellen, you have been making music for, well, your whole life now, and you can categorize it as jazz, but then again, you can't. Why don't you tell us what your music is like?
The music is called avant-garde jazz. I use my voice as an instrument, and it encompasses a lot of elements that are out of the realm of jazz. It encompasses world music, classical technique, and it's very liberating, and we created this at the time when there was loft jazz in New York, and it just resembles a certain freedom of the time, a reflection of that period in history.
So, now I know you've traveled around the world with your music, and you've been incorporating elements of the indigenous cultures as you go. Is that correct?
That is very accurate.
Tell us about some of the places you've been to and how they've influenced your music.
Oh, I was in Western Africa, Morocco. In Western Africa, the way they approach music is much more organic. They don't read music. They're taught solfège to such a degree that they can sing back anything that they hear or anything that you give them. And that process is beautiful because it becomes more soulful in how they approach the music. The music for them is more of a way of life. It's incorporated in their life. They dance, they sing. When they're working, they sing. Every celebration is a dance and singing. The expression is not alienated as it is in our society, where it's very categorized. You sing pop or you sing blues. Their music is just part of breathing. And then in Morocco, you have the influence of the Arabic culture, which is very beautiful. I traveled all over Europe. I traveled in Eastern Europe. And when you travel, you're exposed to different kinds of levels of improvisation, of the intuitive process of creating music. So you learn more.
And the instruments that you encounter in these cultures is different than the traditional instruments we're used to here in Western music. And the tones are different. How does that get incorporated into your sound?
The tones, for example, in Senegal, the way they sing is very nasal, and I can't say it's dramatic like Eastern European music, but it's very soulful, very poignant. And the instruments they use are very simple but beautiful. For example, kora. Kora, I think, has 22 strings, and they're able to shift the tonality. And they sing when they play the kora. It's very, very evocative. In Eastern Europe, they have the semitones. They have a wide array of percussion. And when you're exposed to that, the voice, which is the first instrument, is able to mimic or duplicate and play off those rhythms, play off the different 9/8 or the 6/4s or the 5/8s. And it's a certain fluidity that you develop from being exposed to these different kinds of musics.
Well, let's have a listen to some of these influences. I have a piece here that I'm going to play, Open Your Eyes. Is there anything you want to tell us about it before I play it?
Yes. That particular piece, the man speaking is from Senegal, and he's talking about, in Wolof, which is the dialect of Senegal, he's talking about peace for everybody, common good. And then the lyrics that I wrote just reinforce what he was talking about. But when he was recording, I didn't realize what he was saying, and he didn't realize the words that were previously written. So it's a very interesting sort of psychic combination. You'll hear the music and you'll see it.
Okay, well, let's give it a listen.
Wa mbolo mi mang leen di nuyu di leen sante di leen wax ni dama bëgg waxtaan ak yeen waaw.
Thank you.
Isn't that beautiful?
All day. Yeah. So,
that is so beautiful.
It sounds like you had so much fun making that song.
Oh, yeah, I made that in a studio, in a dance studio. I was producing singers in a dance studio in Torino, northern Italy. And the producer said, listen, you know what? We're not going to produce anymore. You're going to do your own thing. No, just, you know, take jazz and take the instruments that you have here in your studio and create an album using your language and music from your travels and just go for it. And that was one of the songs.
Well, that's good stuff. You also produce, do you not?
Yes, I do.
And you have an artist that you're working with, Aubrey Barnes. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your collaboration with Aubrey?
Aubrey Barnes is what you call a crooner. And he's from L.A. He came to New York, and New York is really hard to live in. It's financially, it's very stressful. So he stopped singing, and we met through friends, and he just sang for me briefly, and I said, oh, my God, I'm going to produce you. So we worked on the repertoire, and what I do is I try to work with him to make each song that we're working on have an individual personality. He has his style, but each song has to be like a very special gem. And Midnight Sun is a beautiful interpretation, a reinterpretation of a classic.
A lot of his music, to me, harkens back to the elegance of the era of Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday, and that whole period. I take it that's where a lot of his influences have come from.
It's very interesting. His influence is from pop, a lot of pop, which is unbelievable, doo-wop, and jazz. But his tone, the interior, the core of his sound, is a crooner. It has that elegance. He has that elegance. He's a very handsome, elegant man. So all those elements just complete this package.
Hmm. Well, let's give Midnight Sun a listen to. This is Midnight Sun by Aubrey Barnes.
Moonlit veil.
The music of the universe all around me. Or was that a nightingale? And then your arms miraculously found me. Suddenly the sky turned pale. I could see the midnight sun. Was there such a night? It's a thrill I still don't quite believe. But after you were gone, there was still some stardust on my sleeve. The flame of it made dwindle to an ember, and the stars forget to shine, and we may see the meadow in December. I see white and crystal line, but oh, my darling, always I'll remember when your lips were close to much for sharing this. Ellen, how can people hear more of your music?
They can go to Facebook or they can go to ellenchristie.com. All the music is there. And they can just...
Do you have any shows coming up?
I'm going to be working in Europe. So it's going to be hard to get to. But they can download the music if they want to. No, they can check me on the internet. They can follow me that way. But the best thing is ellenchristie.com, my website.
And do you have anything new that you're working on?
Yes, I do. I'm working on an album of standards, just voice, bass, and piano. It's beautiful. These are obscure standards, and nobody who knows my work can believe I'm doing this because it's so opposite of what I usually do. That's going to be out in about a month.
That's great. You'll have to tell me all about it, and we'll let everybody
know. Excellent.
Okay.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you, Ellen, so much for joining us. And
thank you.
I wish you all the best going forward, and keep us posted.
I definitely will. Thanks for your generosity.
Okay. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. While we wait for our next guest, I'm going to play another little piece here by Ellen's called Synchronicity. Have a listen. Oh, Okay, that was Synchronicity by Ellen Christie. We're going to go to our next guest now, Diane Lineger. She is a writer, and she recorded an interview with Rick earlier this week.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Diane Lineger, author, publisher, essayist, and consultant of many creative kinds. Welcome, Diane.
Blogger too.
Oh, excuse me, blogger too. Well, that's just a writer who publishes on the web, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a big fan of writing of all sorts, and I can just tell from what I've read of your work, you have an interesting pen. Why don't you talk a little bit about what got you started on the path of the arts and writing?
Well, basically, I'm not a people person, and I like the idea of writing because it didn't involve any human contact.
A writer's life, a solitary one. So you decided to take advantage of it. Very good. Go on.
And I enjoy it. It's therapy.
Well, good, good. Did you know from when you were young that you wanted to write, or did it just climb up on you?
Well, in school, we had to write poems, and usually my poems were one of the best in the class, and I was not a good student, you know, which surprised everybody. It just blew everybody away because, you know, they knew I was not a good student, but yet when I read my poems, they couldn't believe I wrote them.
Well, that's good. When did you start writing poems?
Let's see. The first poem I wrote was in third grade. It was called The Walk.
Very nice, very nice. I didn't start writing poetry till seventh grade myself, and I blame this wonderful English teacher who set me on that path. I'd been scribbling and doing cartooning and playing music before that, but that's when I got launched in the world of poetry. I understand you're working on a book right now.
Yes, I'm co-authoring a book with April Sampson. She's my illustrator. And April does amazing work. She illustrated all of my other books, and I knew April was a great cook. I mean, she started when she told me she started frying an egg when she was like 4 years old, and she just couldn't stop. She just loved it so much. And anyway, I did not know this, but she taught nutrition to lower income women, and I mean, the things she knows about this, I knew we had to collaborate.
Now, as I understand from looking at your notes, you write a range of different material. Why don't you talk about some of the genres that you've worked in?
Okay, I love westerns. I wrote a woman's western, The Valley of Shadows and Shame. I also wrote a children's and adults fantasy adventure called The Kingdom of Sedina, although a lot of people complained I went a little too thesaurus crazy, you know, for children, more for adults, that the children would, you know, stumble over the words. But, you know, when I was a child, my grandfather used to read to me, you know, and anything I didn't understand, you know, he would explain.
Right. So you've written a range of stuff. Is there anything that you could dig up and read a passage of, whether the fantasy piece or the Western romance? Are you?
The Western is not a romance. I do not write romance. I hate romance.
Oh, please forgive me. Which book is handier to you?
Well, how about my volume of poetry?
That sounds fantastic.
Okay, it's free verse. Let me go get my book. Hold on.
Okay.
I'm too nervous to do this from memory. I got to get my old lady glasses.
Sure, get your glasses out. No problem. I don't think of them as glasses. I also think of them as nose strengtheners.
Oh, okay, I'm trying to. Here's a passage from my book. Oh, I just passed it, and I wanted to read it.
Take your time. We can always adjust it.
Okay. This is not the poem, but it's, I dislike romantic novels for the same reason many dislike science fiction. They seem too far removed from reality, which, from my life, yeah. So anyway, let me find a good one here. The one I'm looking for I cannot find.
Go ahead, take a minute. It's all right. No rush. I can always trim the space out.
Okay, it's called TV Evangelicals.
Ooh,
okay.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's Oh Lord, Spare Us All from Those Proselytizing Preachers with Pompadours and Their Pretentious Prattling and Preening While Prancing and Promenading All Pompous and Pious, Shamelessly Pandering and Pleading for Pounds of Pennies from the Poor, Peddling Prayers for Profit, these Pharisaic Palavering Parasites, Perspiring Passionately on a Pedestal, passing a profuse plethora when all piss and pretense.
Very nice, very nice. Now, is that a what I call a mature piece, or is that something you've written recently?
I wrote that, I would say, in the 90s. I do have a brother. He's not with me right now, but he used to listen to Jerry Falwell, you know, every Sunday morning. You know,
oh, my.
My brother was not religious, and I couldn't understand, you know, why he wanted to listen to Jerry Falwell. And he
performance
said, oh,
art?
He happened to see. Well, I have the same name. They're both the Jerrys. And anyway, he happened to see him, I think, coming out of a supermarket or something, and Jerry Falwell, you know, waved at him. And for that reason, you know, he liked Jerry Falwell. But every Sunday morning, he would get up, you know, at 8 o'clock, you know, and turn on Jerry Falwell. And,
oh, my.
You know, I just couldn't understand it.
The Beauty Tip book, you also mentioned in there that you besides giving cosmetic tips, you also talk about how to create your own jewelry. So you're a jewelry artist as well?
No, what I do is I go to thrift shops and I buy, you know, broken jewelry or even, you know, cheap like costume stuff. And I bring it home, and I get out my hammer and pliers, you know, and I take, you know, parts of it, you know, the good parts.
Sure. Repurpose it,
and
yeah.
And I, you know, yeah, I have a lot of, you know, like old hoops that I bought, you know, from thrift shops. And, you know, I put it on the hoops. And sometimes, you know, I don't even use hoops. I take it like an old belt, you know, and cut it in two, you know, I mean an old cloth belt, you know, and cut it in two, you know, and string it on the cloth. And also too, I have made necklaces, you know, out of chain belts too, you know, you just wrap it around your neck, you know, and tuck the ends under. That's in the book. I've got pictures.
Well, that's nice.
And also I do take odd earrings, you know, and, you know, sometimes, you know, put those on a ribbon or an old belt or a hoop, you know. There's a whole lot of things, you know, that I can do. It's even, you know, like flowered hair pieces, you know, like the little hair clips, you know, have the flowers on them.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can make jewelry out of those.
Oh, very nice, very nice. And I understand that you also have your own beauty tips that you share. If I could ask you what I'm going to call a lighthearted question, if there's a common mistake that you think women are making nowadays or something you might suggest to people, what common beauty tip might you suggest to people nowadays?
Wear sunscreen.
Ah, good point. Good point. Good point. Yeah. I noticed from your promotional picture, you have a lovely outfit and a gorgeous hat on. Are you a hat person?
Oh, I love hats. I absolutely do, and I love costumes too. In fact, you know, when I go to the business networking luncheons, I often wear a costume, and I incorporate the costume into my speech.
Well, very nice. So, what costume do you favor? What's the last one that you're wearing? I understand. Did you say you were going to go to a business meeting soon? What costume will you be wearing for that?
Well, that one I might change. I might. We have like 30 seconds. I might get up there and say, "Hey, everybody, listen to me on the radio."
Well, you can certainly do that. Progressive News Network can be found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. And if they click there on Sunday evening, you'll be able to hear it. And, of course, the shows are all recorded, so they can come back anytime. And this is what we're calling the art show. As you may have heard, most of our shows are on Florida political themes or national political themes that are important to Floridians. And once in a while, we take a break and we feature some artists who are also making their own version of a better world. And I think.
Okay, thank you, Rick. Thank you for that very fun interview with Diane Leninger. Our next guest is Samia Halabi. Samia is a Palestinian American who's been an artist her whole life. She's a writer. She's a curator. She's traveled around the world with her art. Samia, so glad you could join us this evening.
Ooh, Renee, it's nice to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Samia, I have seen a lot of your art, and it is simply amazing. But instead of me trying to describe it, why don't you tell our listeners what your art is composed of and what your creative process is?
I will, and I'll try to make it visual. It's very, very hard to describe a painting. But my main artwork is abstract, and I'm very interested in using nature as the source for abstraction, but not making photographic-like images of what is seen outside. So anything that attracts me, I study and examine as I walk around it, see it, think about it, etc., and compare it to others similar to it, and I let all that information sift through me and get into the work. So some are colorful and very busy if they have been inspired by foliage or if they've been inspired by a combination of trees and buildings in a big city like New York. They may be flat slabs of color with some very textured areas. And then that's my abstract painting. It varies. There's a lot to describe, but that gives a good idea. The other stuff I do is I make a documentary artwork about Palestine. I've documented a particular massacre which took place in 1956, executed by the Israeli border guards, killing 49 people in cold blood. And I also document the olive trees of Palestine because they receive the same treatment as the Palestinians. Also, I make political art, but I make it for my own purposes, not to serve anyone else's agenda. As an activist, I've made posters and banners, not only about Palestine, but when you become an activist, you meet people from all over the world, and as they join you to help you in activism for Palestine, you join them in their own activism for their own national liberation or tribal liberation or for workers' unions going on strike and so on.
The massacre and the olive trees, your documentary art, how do you do that? What does that consist of?
Well, that's very different from my abstract work. And I see the abstract paintings as research into the visual language, trying to find new, you know, I believe in the avant-garde, and I want to push the language forward according to our times, our technology, our science, our advancement. On the other hand, when I do the documentary artwork, I make drawings and paintings, and mostly they're in black and white. And the intention is to document as scientifically as possible, and they are illusionistic, and the appearance is very much like Renaissance drawing. That is, I compose them as nicely as I can. I draw their figures and trees recognizable. And I find it very interesting how people react to these drawings. Often, my sister and I both use artwork to demonstrate to people what happens to us in Palestine, what happens to the Palestinians, what is our experience. And people seem to believe an artist's drawing more than they believe photography. Perhaps they've become immune to photojournalism, or perhaps it's wisdom. I feel that the mass of people don't necessarily have a voice, but you can always sense a certain wisdom that comes from large numbers of people voicing their opinion. And I think people feel that photography, especially journalistic photography, though it's important and informative, does not give a total picture as a carefully done drawing, which is the witness of a person over a period of time rather than a flash in a second rushing through a scene.
Sure.
So they're very illusionistic.
Yeah,
and the posters are... sorry, I'm not letting you speak, Renee.
No, that's fine. Please go ahead.
The posters tend to combine pictures and words because I want them to be absolutely blunt and clear. It's my own political persuasion, not anyone else's, so I don't want anyone to make a mistake about what I'm saying. And I don't want to be co-opted. I don't want anyone... You know, one of the most interesting experiences of my life was to see Picasso's Guernica at the Museum of Modern Art and then later see it exhibited on its own in Barcelona. And the difference between the two was immense. If you don't have words and dates and information in a political work, a museum curator can put a paragraph of explanation and completely change the meaning for people who come to it. Anyway, I'll try to be brief and let you conversation, Renee.
No, I find this whole process very fascinating. When you and I met, it was many years ago, and it was on a specific exhibit, Williamsburg Bridges, Palestine. Tell us a little bit about that project and whether or not you're working on any similar projects.
Well, the Williamsburg Bridges, Palestine was done by a committee called Al Jisr Group. And later that same committee was reorganized brought the exhibition Made in Palestine to New York. Both were huge amounts of work. You, I think, helped us with both of them. The first one was so... You were a member of the committee, Renee, and it was great having you. I remember how wonderful it was when we were all collaborating with each other. We had such a great committee. Al Jisr means bridge. So Al Jisr technically means the bridge. And we worked with a curator and an alternative museum in Brooklyn called the Williamsburg Art and the Williamsburg Art and Historical Center in Brooklyn. And we took the space and did the show, and the great success encouraged us to do the next show. But what had happened between the two shows is that a museum in Houston, a private museum, not a state-supported museum, which is a very different thing, invited me to give my opinion about doing a show about Palestine. So I told them if they, you know, I persuaded them to do it of Palestinian artists rather than about Palestinians from artists all over the world. And eventually I took them to the West Bank and Gaza and to all of Palestine, the part Israel occupied in 1948, which we Palestinians call Palestine 48. I took them there to meet artists all over, and Jordan and Syria. And the director, James Herethus, curated a fantastic show. He was amazing to work with and to watch as he had a mental picture of the show, and he kept organizing it as we went. and it was a great success. And he was quite a distinguished curator, once upon a time director of the Corcoran Gallery in Washington. Everyone's heard that about the Corcoran Gallery. So we were working with the top-level people. And then he said he was so excited about the show, he was going to, through his friends, have it travel all over the world. And he was sincere, and he tried very hard. But he had no idea how much Palestinians are blocked from moving forward by the Zionist, international Zionist movement. The 90 museums and friends he contacted all refused, many of them being close enough to him to say, we apologize, but we would lose our support. Even in Venezuela, he ran into a Zionist situation at the Museum of Modern Art. So private committees were formed in three cities, and we formed one of them in New York, and we worked for 2 years. It took all my time for 2 years. You remember that. It was wonderful to work with everyone, and we did some wonderful stuff. And we eventually raised enough money. We opened our own gallery, and we did the opening, and the opening was mobbed.
Oh, yeah.
We had 1,500 people.
That was such a wonderful evening. I always, Tammy, tell me, I always kind of viewed that show as art of the diaspora. You know, I know what you went through to get some of this art into the country. I know there are a lot of pieces that we couldn't get out of Palestine.
They all came out. Sorry to interrupt you, Renee. I think the vast majority of the artists were on Palestinian soil. Well, I shouldn't say the vast majority. There were quite a few who lived outside. But there were two or three from Palestine 48. There were several from the West Bank. There were some from Gaza. In fact, when I took them, it was, I think, in 2003. Gaza had not yet been locked up into a total prison by the Israelis. And I took them in. We went in. Also Jordan, but people should remember that the land of Palestine is surrounded by refugee camps, and the vast majority of Palestinians still live on the land that is Palestine. They may have different ways of pigeonholing us. Refugee camps in Jordan is, by the way, over 65% Palestinian. And Jordan, the government of Jordan being totally, you know, almost totally, it's a puppet of the U.S. government, like the vast majority of governments on this globe, tries its best to suppress Palestinian identity, and people are not really allowed to call themselves Palestinian there. So, but if you push, you scratch, Palestinians are not going to forget. You know, you don't go through the Nakba, the tragedy of 1948, and forget. So you push a little bit, and people tell you, you're in a private taxi cab, and you ask a kid, are you Palestinian? And he'll say, yes, and I was born here, there, and my parents came from here, and my grandparents were born in this village. So everyone remembers the village or the city they were born in Palestine. So, no, the show was not diaspora. By the way, the new word that Palestinians are using for Palestinians outside the borders of Palestine is Shatat. One of the most interesting things that I would like to point to is that there are 500,000 Palestinians outside this immediate area the land occupied by the Israeli entity, and the rest of them are either on Palestinian soil occupied by Israel or in refugee camps within 200 kilometers of around the border. So I interrupted you for a very important point. Sorry about that, but
no,
Palestinians
no,
are
thank you for that
there.
Clarification.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. So, and so there are lots of Palestinians in Syria as well. And Syria was the one nation of all the Arab neighbors of Palestine who treated the refugees best of all. At least they could get papers to travel, and they were, their refugee camps are the most comfortable, the most built up. They're still refugee camps. They're still uncomfortable. The Palestinian refugees are not affluent people. They're poor. They're workers. They're small shopkeepers. But at least they can breathe in Syria, whereas in Lebanon it is very, very difficult. And also, yes, people don't realize there are refugee camps inside Israel. They used to call, you know, Palestinians when in 1948 when they were pushed out of their homes, they didn't necessarily leave the borders of Palestine. Some of that, it was a bloody, messy ethnic cleansing process that the Zionists, the new Israeli state, committed. And people were being pushed around and many killed, and over 60 massacres took place. And so many of the neighboring villages would become hosts for wooden sheds that would be built as refugee camps. They called them barakiyat. And so those old neighborhoods are have become a little built up, but there is nevertheless still groups of people in various places that have come from other villages and towns because they were pushed out of their homes. Mm-hmm. In other words, like me and everyone else who is forced outside the borders, they lost everything, but they are still within the borders.
So your art now, well, tell me, you're working on a book, aren't you?
Yes, I've been very fortunate in joining a gallery. Living in New York has been very difficult because the New York galleries do not accept me. I mean, it's hard for any person of color or any person of a so-called minority in the USA to make it in the galleries, and hard for women. Though it's getting easier for women, and there is this process of just having a token. You have one black artist, one Palestinian artist, one this and that. We have to keep pushing to improve this situation. But I had a very hard time with galleries, but with museums, the curators seem to recognize the value of my artwork, and so I'm in many American museums. But I found this when I started contacting Arab galleries, I found a great reception. It was a wonderful relief. And eventually I found a gallery called Ayam Gallery, which has many branches. Well, it's growing fast. I joined them when they were 1 year old, and now they're 5 years old, and they just opened in London. And I'm going to have my first one artist show in London in a couple of months. It opens October 9th. And the gallery is Ayam London, A-Y-Y-A-M. People can look it up, Ayam Gallery, on the web, ayamgallery.com. And Ayam first did a fantastic catalog for me, the first in my life. I was already 74 and hadn't had anyone make a catalog for me, and I was very excited. 2 years later, they followed it by a huge book, 350 reproductions, full-color reproductions of it. Was like a total history, written by a wonderful, wonderful historian, Maimena Farhat, from southern Lebanon, of both Lebanese and Mexican ancestry, and lives in Brooklyn. And now a big publisher has picked up the book, and it is titled Samia Halabi, 50 years, I think, no, it's called 5 Decades of Painting and Innovation. So it covers 50 years.
Oh, that sounds so exciting.
Thank you. I'm excited. It's really fun to look, take a perspective as an old person. I'm 77, Renee, to look back and see all the things I've done and to enjoy and see that they've been documented in the way that they have been. I consider myself fortunate. I feel very, very privileged, and at the same time, I do not feel, I feel arrogant about it. I have to maintain my humility in the face of knowing that this globe is full of very, very talented, bright people who never have an opportunity to study and to make art and to think, to be scientists. And the sooner we allow, liberate the whole globe, really, and allow education to take over, the better for all of us. And this is my activism here speaking. Nothing could be more beautiful than to have all the people denied nutrition, denied healthcare, denied their democratic rights, to receive all that plus a full high-quality education. The whole world, everybody, all of us would just benefit immensely. We could be moving to a beautiful future instead of sitting here just contemplating a world that seems to be going downhill instead of uphill. Anyway, this is how I feel about it.
Well, we're lucky to have artists like you that will get out there and use their art for more than just creative expression. You use your art to make a difference and to carry a message out to the broader world, and I salute you for all this. What are you working on right now, Samia?
Well, I want to add something else before I answer that question, Renee. What I want to tell to people, and especially to young people, to actually not young artists, but to everybody who's studying anything, I'm often asked, where is Palestine in your work? And people want my abstract painting to be about Palestine. But I feel that there are many things that work in this area, this request that good people and not so good people make of me. And that it's important for us to love where we come from, our origin, and to honor it, and to honor everyone's origin, and to preserve all those wonderful cultures from all over the world. But at the same time, I think it's the responsibility of anybody who has ambitions to be creative, whether it be creative as a mathematician, a chemist, an artist, a writer, to look at the art of the entire globe, at culture and art and knowledge of the entire globe. Because otherwise we are acting like ignoramuses, because we can read any books, we can read translation, we can get to an airplane and go to China, to Africa, we can go to Zimbabwe, we can go to Brazil, we can go to Florida, to Texas, to Alaska, you name it, we can be there, we can go to Hawaii. And we can talk to people. So we read the books and we can go the places. And so we have a responsibility not to put blinders on, so, and to accept all of art as part of your history. And to me, this is what very, very important.
And part of
those
humanity.
Two things, honoring the past, mine and everybody else's, but urging everyone to look forward to a more international future.
Yes.
And what I'm working on now, do we have any more time?
Well, we have about a minute or two.
Okay, I actually, honestly, I'm going crazy preparing for the show in London, and the artwork is very abstract, and I was invited to join a show, and I want to do a piece again that I did the idea is not complete. It's based on a stand of oak trees that I saw in the Midwest, and when I investigated it, I realized that it stands on Shawnee land, and so I called the piece Big Oak, Homage to the Shawnee, and it is a piece made out of many cut-out canvases and painted in all colors of brown, and stitched together and hangs not as a flat painting in acrylic or oil, but as loose bits of canvas all stitched together. Sometimes it looks like branches of a tree hanging from the wall. And so this is my ambition, what's brewing in my mind, and the piece I hope to accomplish before the spring of 2014.
Oh, that's very exciting. I hope you'll keep me posted on that. Tell us, Samia, for our audience, where can they go to see your art for those who can't make it to London for your show?
Well, two places, and thanks for asking me that, Renee. They can go to my website, although I haven't updated it recently. I belong to the most wonderful collective of artists on the web. In fact, it is the first website with artists on it, and there must be about 80 or 50 or 100 and between 80 and 150 artists studios. It's called Art on the Net. Now we've heard art of ArtNet,
right,
because they're commercial, and they've.
We only have a few seconds left, so.
Okay, it's www.art.net/Samia, or www.ayamgallery.com.
Thank you, Samia.
I want to repeat my website.
Please.
art.net/Samia. S-A-M-I-A, and I hope you enjoy what you see. Thank you so much, Renee. You have to come and visit New York now.
I will. I'll be there very soon, Samia. Thank you so much for joining us. That's art.net/Samia and iam.net.com. Thank you.
Thank you
and
so
night,
much.
Everybody.
And good night to everyone, and thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.